So welcome again to program optimization. So we try to determine the effect of procedures, these beasts. And we found a simple way of doing that in the, or a simple, conceptually simple way in the following, that we, if the invariants at broken points we are interested in are from the complete lattice D, then we describe the effect as a transformation D to D, which is again a complete lattice. And then we put up how to determine that transformation. Well, we again put up a constraint system, and the constraint system is this one. And we notice here, so now from a technical point of view, this system, so the right-hand side is of, has constants, so these are constant transformations like the identity, or the transformations corresponding to assignments or guards. And there is the operation, this K here, I already pointed out. This K here. Ah, why doesn't it switch? So sometimes this, the focus is not so, not very precise. So, and that means if I try to click at these little fields, then it clicks somewhere, but not where I intend to click. Now, so in the end, I managed to get that virtual pencil. So now, this, if I have this this edge k, then this either is a constant if it's an assignment, or it is a constant function if it is an assignment, or it is something. There's this operator h, which kind of is able to transform the transformer for the procedure into the transformer for the call of the procedure. And please recall that this H kind of takes care of passing arguments into the procedure and returning results. Or put it differently, it so this procedure has locals or a local state, and one kind of has to determine the local state from the local state before. So it's a new local state, and that is kind of taken care of by that abstract function enter. And later on, from that local state and the local state before, you have to create the state after the call. That is this combine. And this, by these two things, this enter before and combine afterwards, constitute a wrapper for the abstract effect of the procedure F. And that is, but so altogether, every right-hand side in this constraint system either contains one, a single variable, a single unknown, namely the one corresponding to the start point of the edge, or this one together with this beast here, which then is wrapped by H and then composed with the transformer before. And by that we get and once again, this V is the transformation from the start point of the procedure to the current broken point. So that we could kind of write down, and it's an easy constraint system. One constraint per control flow edge plus one for the start point of every procedure, and also then this one here for the endpoints of the procedures. So in that sense, no big deal, and we know by Tarski, by the fixed point theorem of Gnaster-Tarski, if each of all the operations involved in that constraint system are monotonic, then there is a least solution. And we observe now, for that we have to wonder what about the composition and function composition. At least if the functions which you compose are monotonic, then the function composition is also monotonic. So therefore, this is a nice thing. We can, in theory, there's a least solution, and we are done with it. Now, what's the problem here? The problem is the how to represent, how to do the computation. That is, for that we have to rely on some representation of these functions. Now, how do we represent functions all together? So there is one convenient and kind of the function representation 1.0, so to speak. This is, you just list the functional values for each functional argument. Okay, so a value table. But that kind of fails if the value domain, if this D is not finite. And now let's come back to constant propagation. In constant propagation, we have an infinite domain. Why? For every variable, there are infinitely many possible values. Or at least, if not infinite, so if we every integer is possible, and even if we have go from min int to max int, then these are incredibly many values. And then additionally, we have the value top. So the top doesn't make so much a problem, but the other ones, so there are many values. And so we have a problem. If already for one variable we have infinitely many or very many values, and if we have 20 variables, then this means we have 20 times infinity, and that is still infinite. So no hope of listing all the values for all these transform. Representing a single such function. No hope for that. And then the other thing is, if the you have this kind of infinite D as an argument, then this beast has infinite strictly increasing chains. And that is even, that is stupid, because that means that fixed point iteration will not terminate, or need not terminate, to say the least. And why has it strictly increasing chains? Now think of here, these are the arguments. So a function may increase if any of the arguments increases. So you start out with bottom everywhere, and then at some point you get here to 1. And now still you have infinitely many bottoms to be increased. So in the next thing you do another one, which is, so you always get a larger function, and that can happen infinitely often. So there is no hope that we can determine this. Even if we manage to represent these functions, we by some kind of symbolic way, so that there could be we could be successful with that. But then still, we have to cope with the problem that the chains, ascending chains, would be infinite. So that is, there's no hope to compute that precisely. So now, if ascending chains are infinite, we might start thinking about widening and narrowing that we could do, and by that we could manage. But we could also think of constant propagation. So it is so simple, we perhaps do not want to apply widening and narrowing. But we kind of may try other tricks. And now in the rest of this lecture, I will speak about these other tricks. So the first trick is what we always can do. We kind of do not, are less precise. So we give up precision right from the beginning. And that is, we only track constants, or actually copy constants. So what is a copy constant? A copy constant is a value which is not computed. So it is somewhere in your program, there is the value of pi. And then you only check how this value is propagated. And so propagated, it could be by it is assigned to another variable. And that's the only thing. So there's no computation. Whenever a computation happens to a value, then we go to top. And otherwise, we track where this value is copied. So this is good enough for this to take care of the constants due to put into the code for to switch on or switch off features. So that is can still be handled by copy constants. There's another thing, if you have think of that you have your program, some integers originate from enums. So enums are numbers which are compared for equality and whatnot, but they are never, there's no computation going on with enums. So they are just constants. And that also, to a certain extent, would be taken care of by these copy constant analysis. So the copy constant is a little bit more, I would say, relaxed and imprecise, as it also is, at least in the traditional framework of copy constants, people do not interpret guards. So a guard is interpreted as non-deterministic choice. So if then else is interpreted as non-deterministic choice. So conditions are ignored. And otherwise, when we have an assignment, then and the right-hand side is a variable or a constant, then it's exactly, it, and otherwise its assignments are treated as assigning top to X. So this gives us the following abstract semantics of an assignment. If the expression E is a constant, then this x receives this constant. If it is a variable y, it receives the value of y. If it is, in all other cases, x receives top. And now, what does it help us? So it helps us that the range of the so that every variable can only now take finitely many values. And the finitely many values are which ones? Those written in somewhere in the code together and top. So this is a finite set of values, and therefore these mappings from variables to these values is also, there are only finitely many, because there are only finitely many variables, and therefore we have a finite lattice. And I claim that this lattice still is huge. Why? So think of that we have, I think we can do a little bit of a calculation. We have n variables, and then we say we have h constants. Then we have h times h to the power, well, h plus 1 actually. Sorry, I kind of remove it again. So then we have h plus 1 to the power of n variable assignments plus bottom. So, and now if you think of mappings from that to mappings from that value to another value of that kind, how many values are there? So, this is in fact so this is the number of elements, the number of transformations, and this number of transformations is double exponential in the n. You see? On the other hand, how this is the size. Now, what is the height of the lattice d to d? So it is not so if a lattice increases, then you get another, any other, but you can only increase at each for each variable, and for each variable you can increase only what is the height? The height of the lattice, now that I write in red. Height, what is the height? That is, you consider the it is the d to d. So we have to, the number of elements in d times the height, how often in individual d may change. So this is h plus 1 to the power of n. So this is the number of arguments times. And then how often can the times the height of d? The height of d is 3. No, it's 3n. 3 times n. Why? Because for every variable, the value may increase from bottom to a value to top. So in somehow it's like that, more or less, essentially. So I have, perhaps plus 1. So that is kind of the number of updates which potentially may occur. And that is kind of still exponential in n. So this means if you have 10 variables, then, and you have 20 constants, then that is still a lot. Yeah, but it is, in principle, it is finite, so fixed point iteration will terminate, and we are at least, if not happy, so at least kind of happy. Yeah? So now, that is, that is what a rough estimation would yield. If one did the fixed point iteration, then one would find out that the fixed point iteration terminates much faster. And also that the occurring functions which occur during fixed point iteration are not arbitrary, but of a particular form. And that kind of is, now that let us see what kind of format in fact only occurs. So it turns out that the functions which occur all, there are two kinds of functions, either those which return bottom all the time, so this is one function, this one. And there are the other functions, these other functions are real transformations. And they transform a variable assignment to another variable assignment. And it turns out that all of them can be represented in this particular form. And it says the value at the end, the value of x at the end can be constructed in the following way. It is the least upper bound of some constant b, which could also be bottom, and then there would be no constant. The least upper bound of this constant and the values of a subset of variables at the beginning of the execution. And why is this so? So think of each individual execution through a procedure, for example. Then what can happen to the variable x? Either it is assigned a constant, and then this constant survives until the very end, then it's constant. So then this is this constant. Or what can also happen along the path is that that x does not receive a constant, but it receives the value of some variable which is kind of copied from one variable to another variable to another variable and so on, and ultimately arrives at x. So that is the value of some variable y at the beginning. And now, since there are many program executions, each of the contributions, each of these paths contributes either such a constant or it contributes the value of some variable. And altogether, all these effects together can be kind of summarized by such a description. Now let us look at such a description we have to provide for every variable. Now let us once more look at quite technically at this description. How complicated is it to write it down? Now you see that the only thing what we need is this b together with a subset of variables, and that we have to represent for every x. Yeah, and now if you have and you apply this kind of this representation, if you want to apply it to a variable assignment d, then what do you do? Okay, so then you simply evaluate, if you want to know the x after the transformation, you take the you look at the definition of x, which is this expression here, then you take the b, you evaluate in d the y's, and take the least upper bound of all that things. So application is, in that sense, quite easy. And we see that now how can such a value, if you consider all these mappings M, how can a value increase, such a transformation increase? It may increase by that the B increases. Now this is, how can the B increase? It's a constant. So it's either it's bottom, then it's not there, or it is a constant, say 5, or it is top. If it's top, then everything, the top least upper bound with anything is top, then at that point x does not depend anymore on any variable. So it can increase only by by providing the constant, by providing more elements here in this set of variables which may contribute to the value of x. So this is k plus 1, and then it may otherwise, so k plus 1 and then one more to go to top, so the number of increases is k plus 2 for the variable x. And now if you have k variables, then this means you have k times k plus 2, which is of order k squared. So this is the number of increases to a transformation. And so this means fixed point iteration will not be go for too long, because that's polynomial in some sense in the number of variables, and that's acceptable. Yeah, and then yeah, and for that we, in order to yeah, and then we kind of can say how is so that is kind of so I kind of said that the ordering on this complete lattice is that either the B increases or one of these the set I of variables increases, and altogether one. According to this ordering, if we want to determine the least upper bound of two such sets, we kind of do it component-wise for each variable, and for each variable we do it component-wise by doing the least upper bound on the b's, and then the least upper bound over the and the union of the sets I of variables. And then now we may wonder how can we, if this is a nice representation of the transformations, where we do not have so much, so it's a nice representation of these transformations, M, can we compute with it, them? Can we compute, for example, and that is the crucial point, can we compute, not black, can we compute the composition of two such transformations, but yes, we can, and that essentially amounts in the following. Assume that the B1, the M1 is has a constant B and a set I, and then we have a transformation M2, which for every variable set has a constant B set and no, sorry. M1 apply to X should be of this form here, and for every set M2 is of that form. And you see, because I start with the I kind of calculate backwards. I want to know what is the result for the variable X. So the result for the variable x is returned by M1. And M1, by M1 applied, so in that sense, we want, so this M2, M2, it's not applied to x, but the M, so it's thinking of some D, and then there is this M2, and then there is this M1, and that gives me an assignment which I may apply, which I may query for X. And now, how is that determined? So the value, the M1 returns this assignment to variables, and that now the value for X is determined by starting out with a B0, and then taking the least upper bound over all the values for the Ys from that set I. Now, how are the values I obtained? Now, the values I are obtained by kind of querying the values of the set, the Ys in I. So for each Y, we have to query the variable assignment returned by M2. And that is, and these are provided here. So that is all together. If I plug these things together, each of these variables which I query, may come with a constant B set from the returned by the provided by the M2. So these two, the B together with these B sets together, give me the B prime of the composition, and the set I of all of variables which are altogether may contribute to the value of X, are obtained by taking the union over all the sets in I over the I set. Yeah, so all these sets provided for the variables in I taking the I sets, the union over the I sets where the set is provided by the I. So that is kind of an operation which you can kind of evaluate. So it's a kind of formula, if you like, which you can do just having the representations of M1 and M2 at hand, and the result is then the composition of the two transformations. Now, having a composition, the other thing which we need is the identity as a constant and the assignments as a constant. The identity as a constant, obviously, is very easy. This is represented by the identity is represented by X is mapped to X for X inverse X variable. So this is easy. And now the assignment. Let us see. So if the C is a constant, then this kind of you take the identity for all variables besides the X, and X is mapped to set to C. So in that sense, this is an expression, if you like, in the format of M. So it's in the format of our of the which we considered here in this format here. And the same happens if we have an assignment X receives the value of Y. In that case, you have the identity everywhere, only X is mapped to Y. And then the final case is when X when E is neither a constant nor a variable, then X is set to top, and that also fits into that format. So in this sense, everything is, we stay within the world of this type of assignments, and therefore fixed point iteration will compute the will can be applied to solve this constraint system. Now let us see in our little example program what this analysis will give us. So there we had the global variable A, the global variable red. Then there was, I think there. Here's the example program. There was no local variable B, so this makes this life, the life here very simple. The only local variable which we had was the T, not the B. There is only this T variable in main. And work has no, there is no further local variable. Okay, and then there is this A1, and then there is this red. These are the only variables which we now have to take care of. And now let's see what goes on here. So this assignment T equals 0 corresponds to this transformation. All other variables receive their values. Then this assignment A1 to T receives T is kind of represented by this transformation. A1 receives the value of T, and all others stay the same. Yeah, and this, should please read this one as follows. A1 receives the value of T before the transformation. Okay, so now one more thing we have to, which is important for the analysis. This is this fabulous transformation H. The H takes the transformation of the procedure and transforms it into the transformation for the call. What must happen there? Well, if M is the transformation of the procedure, so now what do we have to do? Okay, so M before executing M, we kind of have to create the value of the local state before the call. And that is done by means of this function enter. Now, what is enter? Enter is again a transformation like this M. And what does it do? All the globals stay the same, and all locals are set to 0. So this is a transformation of our liking. If you take this passing of parameters, if you like, or not passing of parameters, of initializing the locals of the called procedure, and then we can kind of do the composition with M, then that is what happens. That is the transformation from before the call, the state, into the state after the call. From that, we are only interested in the values for the globals. So we can restrict it to the globals. And then we can kind of, and from the transformation before the call, we can kind of, we restrict, so that is the identity, the locals kind of the caller are not affected by the call procedure. So we can kind of take the partial identity on them, and then update only the globals according to this. Yeah, so altogether, we therefore arrive at a nice little formula, which which we can evaluate given M to determine the effect of the call. So let us see a little example how we can do it. Okay, so we can do it. Here is the assume that, so we have we have this procedure work. So that was in the example, and assume that by some fixed point iteration, I don't know how, we arrive at this transformation here for work. Okay, so this assume that work has the following effect. It preserves the A1, it preserves the tea. It preserves the tea. Or we could even say, I guess it doesn't even make a difference. We could say the tea is set to zero. If we like, the tea is set to zero and the return value is set to A1. Now then we would like to apply the H. No, sorry. The work does not affect the T. So we have that transformation. Now then applying the work around the H to this transformation would do the following. It kind of takes the identity on the locals of the caller. The caller has only the local variable T, and takes that thing here. Now, what is that thing? I said this is the composition of work with enter and then projection to the globals. So, work, enter, would do what? Enter is set, enter keeps the globals as is and sets the locals to zero. Now T, assuming that every procedure has a local variable T, which is not the case, work has no local variable, but assuming that it has also this local variable T, then we would set that to zero and then apply the transformation of work. And that gives us A1, red gets A1, and T gets zero. And then, and this we have to project to the globals, and projecting that to the globals means that this one goes away, and we only keep this A1 to A1 and red to A1. And that has to be combined with the identity on T, and altogether we therefore arrive at that. Okay, so this is the effect of the call. Yeah, T is kind of preserved, and A is also preserved, and red is set to A1. Okay, so that's kind of a little warm-up, how we apply this H to transformations. Now let's see what fixed-point iteration gives us here for this work. For the work thing. We want to determine, so this work is a recursive procedure. In principle, it is a recursive procedure, and therefore we have to do fixed point iteration. So we do it in the round robin fashion, because that's the one which we can easily evaluate on the slide. So we start, so in which color? So let's say that we do it in green. So with red, in green. So with 7, we start out with the identity. Okay. So then we proceed to I have made the ordering that I then kind of evaluate 9 and then 10 and only then evaluate the 8. Yeah, for some reason, I do it like that, and then for 9, I have nothing happens in the first go, because 8 has not yet been reached, and therefore I receive this the identity for program point 9. I go to 10, which does the assignment, so I compose with the transformation for the assignment, which means that now I have this one here. Yeah, red receives the value of A1, and then I do the 8, and 8 is the same as 7, so it is again the identity. Okay, so now I have to do this. To do what? I have to do the next iteration. So the next iteration goes again, looks at 7. So that's maybe we make it in yellow now. It's the same. So now let's go for the 9. So 9 has to do the following. It has to take the identity, which arrives from which arrives here. So that is the identity, and that has to, we have to take the least upper bound of that with the value arriving here. And here we now have to apply the h applied to the current value of work. The current value of work was the value which the current value of work was this one. Sorry, not that one. Was this one. Everywhere identity outer red is set to A1. And the H applied to this one we have already computed. And that was the same. Okay? So H has no effect here on that. So this we need to know, because that means that now we have to do the least upper bound of the identity coming from here. And this one where the return value receives A1. So this the least that it gives us this super duper expression. Why? Because least upper bound was done component wise for every variable. So this therefore the least upper bound twice the identity on A1 and T is fine. So it's just A1 maps to A1, T maps to T, and for the return value, one is the identity, one assigns A1, so therefore we have the least upper bound of A1 and red. Okay, so this is now the value at 9, and the value has increased, because before, at that point, we had just A1, just red. Okay? Now we proceed to 10. If 9 to 10 gives the assignment, red receives the value A1, okay. So this kind of thing again disappears for 10. And because there's an explicit assignment of A1. And then we proceed to, and then we again may reevaluate 8. This has no particular effect, and therefore, yeah. So therefore that's it. And then with this the fixed point iteration terminates, because the next round will not produce anything more. The value of 10 has not changed, and that is, in the next round the value of 9 will be the same as the current value of 9. Okay, so that is, by that we really succeeded to determine the effect of the procedure work, although it is recursive. Okay, now, so what does it buy us? So we have the kind of the summaries for the procedures. Now, that simply means that we know for call edges what the effect is. And now that is, now we can do an intra-procedural analysis. Or we can kind of not an intra-procedural analysis, or we can put up a constraint system which tries to approximate the values possibly arriving at the program point. And this is this R, or reachability information, which we want to compute. So this means we determine the main, how is the start point of main reached. Well, that we assume that there's a value D0 which describes the state before the call, before program execution starts, and then we do the enter. By that we enter the program execution starts with a call to main. So at the start point of main, we therefore have the value enter of D0. So D0 accounts for the initialization of the globals and that kind of information things. Okay? So then similarly, whenever we reach whatever we have at the start point of a call, then we apply enter to it, and this gives us a contribution to the start node of the function f. And then we might ask if we have then the start node of the node V receives the value R of F. So because in that sense the start node is kind of receives all these values by which I enter the procedure F. And then whenever I have an ordinary edge K, I apply the transformation of K. This is from D to D to the value D at program point U. And that gives me the contribution, a contribution to the endpoint of the edge, which might be V. So this is this one. Okay, so this looks like an ordinary constraint system, which we had so far. The only difference is that now we have these for this we have several entry points, namely the entry point of main, which gets this constant, and the entry points of every procedure, which kind of receive contributions from all the call from all the call edges. This is kind of different, and also there is one more little complication. That here inside, this edges here are not only assignment edges, but these are also call edges. But the transformations for the call edges we have determined in the preceding round. So we can evaluate all that. And now this is an evaluation, a constraint system not over D to D, but this is a constraint system over D alone. So if D has finite ascending chains, then we are done and happy. And so in the example, we can apply that. Now we compute not with transformations, but we compute with just plain variable assignments. And so let's see what we get for main, for example, in our favorite stupid motivating example. So it's starting point at program point zero. All the locals, all the at program point zero. This is the start point of main. We arrive there. The contribution there is obtained by applying enter to some d zero. So this d zero I have assumed. So d zero maps everything, all the variables to top. Yeah, initially, so right from the beginning, nothing has a value, and then I apply enter to D0, and that means that the locals are at least initialized to 0. So therefore, the T receives the value 0. So here, you might say that in C, your globals are also initialized with 0 or so. So in that sense, one might perhaps say in the beginning also the globals here have value 0. But that's a matter of taste. So we may do it in this way or in that way. So by that we arrive at program point one. Now if we are in this copy constant environment, then we would not evaluate the conditions, but make a non-deterministic branching. And that means that we arrive at program point two. And in program point two, program point one, I remove all these scribblings, and again, now we are at program point one. We again assign 0 to T, so that is no change to the state. Now we may proceed to program point two, then no change to the state because it's the guard was ignored. Then we may go to three, which is there are two incoming edges, and one is the identity, and the other is also the identity, so no change. Then we proceed to four. There's an assignment of T to A1. Now T has the value 0, so therefore now A1 also has the value 0. Now now comes the call of the procedure work. For that we have determined the summary, and that says afterwards red has the value of A1 and all the other values stay the same. So red has the value of A1, so therefore it receives the value 0. So this gives us this five thing. And then we have to traverse the last edge from 5 to 6 and evaluate 6. And there red is computed by some expression, and it's too complicated for us, so therefore we give it the value top. So here it is. So then there is no cycle in that, so it's done. Okay? So we managed to evaluate this to the constant propagation here. Okay? And so what we found, so now what is the kind of takeaway? First, this copy constants have a nice the transformations which for the representing the summaries of functions for copy constants are so easy, or so that we can nicely describe them, and we can compute them interprocedurally. And we had to, for that we ignored conditions and also complex assignments. Ignoring complex assignments might perhaps not we may say complex assignments are overrated, but conditions are not overrated. So usually constant propagation may gain a lot of information out of conditions. Or by evaluating conditions, we might find out that certain broken points are dead, which is very valuable information. So therefore, ignoring conditions is on the negative side. And but that is only for the summaries. What we do in the second phase is whatever we like, because we have sound information. So in the second phase, we could do full constant propagation. And only when there is a call, we only track copy constants through the call. So that is a decent compromise, and to gain something. So that would mean in this particular example, if we do the full constant propagation in the second phase, we would refer to the copy constants only for the work, and would find out here at that point that red has the value 0, therefore we would then put here 1 in the end. So then we see the return value will be 1. In this little example, that would do it. We would not be able to kind of find out that the that would be it. Okay, so that's for the copy constants, and the second phase where we could do full constant propagation. And but now then we still it's a little bit we are not very happy, but we had to do it, or we kind of thought that we have to do it, because the set of occurring transformers must be finite, and functions must be somehow efficiently the transformations occurring during fixed point iteration somehow must be effectively, at least, or efficiently implementable. We must have an explicit representation of functions. If we don't have that, then somehow we are doomed. And interestingly, all these extra restrictions in some cases can be abundant. That is, even if we have this constant propagation, and even if the tables which we would have to write down are possibly infinite, we still could be maybe successful with such a full constant propagation, for example. Now, how is this possible? And this is an idea which was somehow simultaneously in their individual papers, which kind of nicely ignored each other. It was present in both of them right from the scratch. And there was, namely, there was the idea that, yes, the summary of a procedure may require an infinite table, if the lattice D is infinite. But during the actual fixed point computation, we are not interested in the full least fixed point, because the full least fixed point would tabulate the effect of each procedure for every possible argument. But during the real fixed point, during the real execution of the program, and also during fixed point iteration, it might not be necessary to look at all the arguments. Maybe it suffices to look only at a small subset of arguments. Yeah? So that is, we kind of decompose, so that is now the trick, we decompose this holistic summary for a function into a lot of individual pieces of information. Namely, we want to determine the return value, the effect of the procedure for a particular calling context A. And then we want to do it for an A prime, and then for an A double prime. And if we only, so in principle there are now, there's, the, we kind of replace a finitely many things, namely the summaries for the procedures, which have an untractable representation, by possibly infinitely many things, which each of them has a tractable representation. Namely, we can consider now individual variables f, a. And this is the result state of the procedure f when at the entry point of f there is a. And now we hope that we only have to look at not all of the not all of these pairs f, a, but only at few of these pairs. Okay? So that's the idea. And so in principle we write down now an infinite constraint system. It's no longer finite, it's infinite, but the values of this constraint system are no longer over transformations, but just over ordinary, over D. So here is, so the value, the state returned by the transformation for F, for A, is that what we obtain at the exit point of F. In the context, in the calling context A. Okay, so that means now for every program point of F, we have to determine the value of this program point comma A. So this is the state, the abstract state attained at the program point, at a particular program point, whenever the function has been called for A. So in some sense, you could also say I make a copy of F for every calling context A. So if I have the start point of a procedure F, and that start point is V, then there in the call, in the context A, I have A there. So this kind of gives us this very first constraint. Now then, if I have an ordinary, like an assignment or a guard, and I have an edge U to V, then the value of V in context A is obtained by the value of U in context A by applying the transformation corresponding to that edge. So it's actually that what we expect there. Yeah. So it's like before, only that we added this A. Now the interesting thing is what happens at the call. So what happens at the call? So now, again, removing all these stupid yellow things, now let us again look at that. So here we have a call. Now what happens? So the first thing is what we have to do is we want to determine the value at the endpoint of the call in for this A. Okay? So we start out with the value which we have at the start point of the edge, in this context A. Then we apply the enter. This gives us the start configuration in for which F must be evaluated. Now F must be evaluated, so that means this enter thing here is now the second component. So So this makes it it's interesting. So this enter here, this value which we determine, determines the calling context for the F. So this is the second component. And that has a return value, which is this one, which we have to combine with the value before the call. Okay? You understand this expression, this nesting of the enter into the second component of the F. So now there's an interesting effect, is kind of indirect addressing. So depending on the value U, A and what enter returns for it, we select the second component of the F. So this is clear because we kind of we don't know in which context. So beforehand we don't know what is the context in which F is called, and so we don't know what the but that we only determine during fixed point iteration. So this is an instance of what I have announced earlier, and which you might not have believed at that point, that variable, that the number of the precise variables which are queried in the right hand side might not be known statically. This is an instance here, because in fixed point iteration, say that we have values, the enter U of A may be values A1, then A2, then A3. And this means that here on the right hand side of this variable, we will access F of A3 in the end, and before we had accessed F of A2, and before we consulted F of A1. Yeah? So that in that sense, the variables which are accessed change over time, during fixed point iteration. It's not fixed a priori. Okay? You see that? This strange effect? And that means a fixed point algorithm which kind of tracks variable dependencies has a hard, which kind of statically requires the static variable dependencies, will have a hard time here. So it's better, therefore, to have a fixed point algorithm which kind of dynamically determines the variables. Yeah. So that's the idea here. Now, so what we observe is, so we can write down, so we define this constraint system. We can write it, so this definition is nice to write it down. And it's so somehow down there is something like a little note, footnote A. This we may do for every A in D. But this little footnote indicates that there are possibly, so for constant propagation, there are infinitely many constraints. So that means, we cannot spell that constraint system out as a whole. And we do not want to do that. And actually, we do not want to do it because we cannot hope to solve it completely, but what can we do? So we can say, okay, I want to know the value of at the end of main for this A0 where A0 is enter D0. And if we kind of query the value at the exit point of main, then may apply our local fixed point algorithm, and then the local fixed point algorithm will access only those variables which contribute to that value. And these this traverses only certain contexts, and these contexts are the only ones which occur during, not only during fixed point computation, but also during execution of the program. And the hope is that only finitely many contexts must be determined, must be looked at to answer this query. So we do the fixed point computation not as a whole, but a query driven. We ask a question and ask the fixed point algorithm to determine only the values which are required to answer the query. And so let us see what happens here in this little example. If we proceed like that and do full constant propagation now, but we make it in this query-driven fashion. So that would mean the initial context of main, which we query, is... So here is the tabling, which I do. Let me see. I do not track the value of t, because the value of t is always zero. So that is for A1 and red, I have always top. So that's in the initial query I ask is, please give me the return value of main for the context top comma top. Yeah? And then, so that is, for that, this is a query which we ask here. And now, because the return value of main is determined by querying the endpoint, which is 6 of main. So in order to what would the local fixed point algorithm do? The local fixed point algorithm would say, okay, I want to have main top comma top. In order to do so, I have to determine the value of 5 top comma top. And that is, in order to have that, I need the value of 4 top comma top and so on and so forth until I arrive here. And that is the first thing where the right hand side does not depend on any further variables. So therefore for main, I can say, for the program point 0, I can say, okay, for that I get the value of A1 and red is top comma top. So having determined the value at 0, the local fixed point algorithm will succeed to determine the value of 1, which is for A1 and red still top comma top, because only t will have the value 0. Then I may continue with program point 2. So there I will find... here, top comma top. Sorry, I'm in this... This is the context. This is the context, and these are the values for the context. So these two things I have evaluated. Now I proceed to program point 2. So that asks, what is the value? Is the value of t positive? The answer is no, because t is 0. Therefore, I arrive at bottom there. Then I now proceed to program point 3. And neg t is true because it's 0. And then I have to join with bottom. So this gives me top comma top. So then I proceed to program point 4. At program point 4, A1 is set to t. So that means A1 receives the value 0. Then I have to do the... Then now I want to proceed to program point... I want to evaluate the right-hand side to continue. I continue with the evaluation of the right-hand side of the constraint for 5. But there is, inside that, there is this call to work. So now I have to evaluate this expression, combine the value before, which I have already, with the return value returned by work. But now for which context? The context for work is this one. A has the value 0 and return has the value top. Yeah, because that's the... But now I query the... I start with 10 in order to get to obtain the return value for that of work for that context. I have to query the value of 10 for that context. Now the value of 10 depends on 9, okay, and that on 8, and that on 7. So that is the next program point where I can do an evaluation is program point 7 for the context 0, top. So now we are here. Okay, so that receives the value 0, 0, top. That's the start point of the, that was our constraint there. That in this context, we have at the start point exactly that value. Now we proceed to program point 8. So we ask, is A0 positive? And the answer is no, because it's 0. So therefore we have bottom at program point 8. And then we may proceed to 9. Okay, so that is the join of the neck A1, which is true. So therefore we proceed there. And bottom, so therefore we arrive at the same state as we had at program point 7. And then we do the assignment red receives A1, and that gives us 0, 0, because now red also receives the value 0. So both have the value 0. By that, we have the finished the evaluation. We have determined the value of work for the context 0, top. This is 0, 0. This we combine now with the value before the call, and we return here, and evaluation there results in that A1 is 0 and return value is also 0. And then at program point, then we may proceed to, we eventually evaluate the program point 6 and thus the return value of main, and we find that this is 0, 1. And now we are done. So you see, everything what could be computed, the fixed point algorithm did it for us, and it consulted not all possible contexts, but only those which really mattered here. Okay. In fact, both main was only analyzed for one context, and work was also analyzed for one context, interestingly, and that is because the recursive calls of work were never accessed. So therefore, we only had to analyze one call of work. So that is in the as a conclusion, we find that in the example, everything terminated tremendously fast. And and we find in general, if this D has finite height, this analysis will terminate whenever each procedure is analyzed only for finitely many arguments. So this is a weak termination guarantee. In fact, one can prove even something more. At least we are currently we are writing that up. One can prove even that this analysis terminates whenever, under the only assumption that that there are no recursive procedures. And that is, in many cases, in C programs, for example, people hate to write recursive procedures. So that would mean this type of analysis would terminate always. So that is one thing, but even if there are recursive procedures, it is still, this is a quite common situation that each procedure has to be analyzed only for very few contexts. And that is perhaps another side remark. What we developed here is also applicable to other, not only to imperative programs. What is that? So I wonder, is it so that that small children have this ability to make these cries which go through your heart, not through the heart, in that case it's only through the ears and the heads, and kind of cause the utmost pain. So children are nice, but not when they make such sounds. Okay, so that, but just so prologue kind of can be, it is interesting that, and perhaps if we have time in the end, we may have a look at that. You can, there you have not procedures, but you have predicates, but the analysis of prologue still is surprisingly similar to that of imperative programs, and there one has can play similar tricks. Yeah, and then also one might say, kind of, it is always in this evaluation of lectures, you always are asked, does the lecture show connections to current work and to research? And I can tell you that we have a quite successful analyzer running on C, and which also does concurrency, which kind of builds on that type of interprocedural analysis. Perhaps one might also say that not everybody, so the community in the programming language community is kind of split into the US community and in the European community. And while this functional type of approach is quite popular in the European community, it is kind of discarded on the US side of the community, and it's Euroscience, so to speak. They consider that as too expensive for practical applications, which is not the case, but they have the fixed opinion, this is too expensive, and they say we do this other type of analysis, which is this call string approach, which is very popular in the US. And so what is there the idea? The idea is, we know this intra-procedural analysis and we try to do the same for also in presence of procedures. And we only have to track a little bit the history, how we arrive at the call. And that is what they call the call string approach. And that is the call string approach, and that means you kind of think of you instead of this, they kind of look, they kind of start out with this representation of an operational semantics where you track the where you have a transition system where you have individual steps which were between configurations containing the stack. And that is, and then you can kind of do a similar analysis. The only problem is that there possibly all that in general there could be infinitely many such stacks. And what can you do then? So then, what they do is, we only consider stacks up to a certain depth. And that is, if the depth grows too large, then they kind of throw it together and forget it. And so let us visualize the idea for the most simple case, and that is when we consider stacks of depth zero. So that what does it mean? It means that we only track one stack frame, and that means the following. So here in the example, this means. We kind of introduce. We say when we are here at that point, at before the call to work, then we simply can continue with work, and we have to apply this enter, because now the variables have new values. Then we go through. Here is another call. And there we can also apply the enter and go to broken point 7. And that we can do. And here at the end point, we kind of return to all the call edges, all call edges. So we may return here or we may return there. So let me remove all the scribblings. You see all these edges. There's a little bit of extra things here. This combine has to, there is 10 and 4. The values there must be jointly accessed and to provide the contribution for 5. But besides that, it's just this extended graph. And so the constraints for that can be much more easily written down. So for example, the constraint for program point 5 then looks as follows. So let us, what is 5? So it is this this program point. And so we have to take the value at 4, the value before the call, and the value at 10, this is the at the end of work, and combine them. This gives us this constraint. And like the same is for broken point 9, let us go back. Broken point 9, this is this beast here. It takes, it's the endpoint of the other call to work, and so we combine the value before the call, 5, with the value at the endpoint of the call of the procedure with 10. So this gives us this constraint. Okay? So you see, so that we simply ignore the contexts, and that's all. And now then also then the other edges. Here, this 4 thing is the point before the call, and this gives a contribution to the start point of work by means of enter. So this 4 thing gives us this contribution to the start point of work, and this one is the contribution of the other call. Yeah, again, we simply ignore the context and write that down. And clearly this is a little bit of an over approximation. It's not too bad, but it's an over approximation. And because we kind of now have impossible edges, because so therefore it's an over approximation. So it could be so that we could do here, you can think of that I iterate here all the time. Or I could kind of, another thing which I could do is I could start out here and then go there. Or, yeah, so here are, this is another infeasible path, or I could arrive from, which I visualized here, I arrive here, then I go there multiple times, and then I go there. So this is is a path which is not not available in the, it does not correspond to any program execution. So you have more behaviors in a sense than you would the real program execution has. But more behavior is not bad, because it only means that we have less precise values. So you can do that. Our example is so stupid, this little example, that the more the imprecision has no effect. So we still would compute everything. And in essence, computationally, this means we analyze every procedure only for the join over all values for which a procedure is called. So that is, in some sense, a secure information which we compute one information for a procedure which is good for all different calls. So if a procedure is called in very different contexts, then this might dangerous. If we, in the context of compilers, it's not so stupid, because that means what we compute is safe for all calls, then we might optimize the procedure accordingly, and because then we perhaps might know that a global has always the value 5, because it has the value 5 whenever the procedure was called in the program. But still, if we think of that our procedure is potentially be called also in other contexts which are not known to the compiler at when processing this particular file, then we still have to make a copy and optimize the procedure for that copy. So in that sense, the gain is not so much, but at least one can there is some gain that we analyze the procedure only once, and perhaps, and that is kind of what people believe, is that this is a gain in efficiency, and in particular there is a termination guarantee, because now we do not need to split to analyze a procedure for every possible context, but only analyze each procedure once, so that the analysis already terminates whenever only the complete lattice D has no infinite strictly ascending chains. So that's kind of this is kind of one idea what one can do. Actually, by our implementations, it turns out that this kind of analysis is not necessarily faster than the one with local solving and contexts. And the reason is, since the analysis is less precise, and that means the chains are longer. And that means you have to analyze the function multiple times, yes, because the fixed point iteration takes longer. And if you are more precise, you have more contexts, then things are kept apart, and the result being more precise means that it is a lower value, so that the fixed point iteration is terminates faster. So taking this effect into account, so it's not so clear what is the best method to the best method to do here. Okay, so that is one thing. So it terminates. There is a termination guarantee. We may wonder, is this approach correct? And the correctness here can be nicely shown relative to the operational semantics based on call stacks, because that's the natural. This is natural here, and so that would kind of, this terminates our discussion of the interprocedural case. The next topic which we would like to attack is the question of what do we do with hardware, and the sub area of hardware which is most the most settled one is the treatment of registers, and we will therefore start out with a treatment of registers. How do we do register allocation and things like that? And so there will be next week one more lecture on Wednesday. So I wondered whether we should kind of skip it, but Javier Esparza told me no. We should should be disciplined, and it's a regular teaching day, so we will have a lecture on Wednesday morning at 10. So there we will speak about registers. And today at 2 o'clock in my Sprechstunde, we will kind of, you are invited to show up, and we will try to nail down certain projects where you can get this extra bonus. Yeah? So then, thank you for your attention, and we see us at 2.